Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm very happy to welcome you this morning to our session on American competitiveness, part of the Business and Society track sponsored by Ernst & Young. And I am publisher of The Atlantic. We're partnering with the Aspen Institute and putting together the Aspen Ideas Festival with the participation of sponsors, including Ernst & Young, and we thank them for that. I have a few housekeeping issues and updates to start our day. We have a big day today. First of all, please turn off cell phones and pagers entirely off. That will help with the audiovisual. Second, I know everyone's very interested in President Clinton's session this afternoon at 2 o'clock. So listen up. All pass holders will get in. You do not need tickets. There are not assigned seats. But you do need to wear your pass. You are not going to be able to get in without this for security reasons. So please do wear your pass. All the doors to the music tent will be open. They'll be open at 1:30. The plenary sessions will end at 1:30, so you will have plenty of time to get to the music tent. Again, plenary sessions will end earlier at 1:30. There's one location change for today, the session on Turning the Tide, Sustaining the Ocean Harvest, which is a tutorial from 10:45 to 11:45, will now be in the Heinz Room of the Kresge Building, not indoor Hozier. There are three time changes. Sports and Society was originally scheduled for the afternoon. That will now be at 10:30 in the Booz Allen Hamilton room in the Koch building. What's Next in Healthcare Delivery will move from the morning to the afternoon. So essentially those sessions are flipping. What's Next in Healthcare Delivery will now be at 3:30 to 4:45 in the Kaufman room at the Dorr Hozier Center. And finally, the live taping of Studio 360 at the Hotel Jerome will start an hour earlier. That will be this evening at 7 p.m. and will run till 9 p.m. So those are all the announcements for this morning. So this is our session on American competitiveness, and if anyone is interested in a different form of American competitiveness, I will let you know that Venus Williams beat Marion Bartoli in the women's final at Wimbledon, resounding beating 6-4, 6-1. So that was done quickly. Today's topic, though, is one of business and markets and American competitiveness. And for that, we have to thank Ernst & Young, who's the sponsor of the Business and Society track. This is actually their third year as a sponsor of the Aspen Ideas Festival. They were a founding sponsor and have been here with us all along. So thanks to E&Y. I wanted to take a moment to introduce our panelists this morning. And I will start with Stephen Friedman, who is going to moderate the panel. He's right at the center there. He's the chairman of Stone Point Capital, LLC, which is a private equity firm investing in financial services businesses. He's the former retired chairman of Goldman Sachs, a graduate of Cornell University and Columbia University School of Law. He is the chairman of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, as well as the Intelligence Oversight Board. And he served as an assistant to President George W. Bush for Economic Policy and Director of National Economic Council. So Steve will be our moderator, and he's seated right at the center. On my far right, your far left, is Jim Turley, who's chairman and chief executive officer of Ernst & Young. He's celebrating his 30th anniversary with the firm this year. He joined in 1977 in the Houston office after undergrad and graduate degrees at Rice University, and he's now based in New York and London and is managing a business that spans 140 countries and 114,000 people. To Jim's left is Tom Wilson, who is the president and CEO of Allstate Corporation. Tom came into that post in January after serving as president and COO of the company, and he is a company man, having served in several senior leadership roles, including CFO. He joined Allstate in 1995 from Sears Roebuck, where he was vice president of strategy and analysis, and has had career stops as well at Dean Witter and at Amoco. So thank you for being here, Tom. Next is Bob Steele, so to the left of Steve Friedman. Bob is Undersecretary of the U.S. Treasury for Domestic Finance. He leads Treasury's activities with respect to the domestic financial system, fiscal policy and operations, government assets and liabilities, and related economic and financial matters. He retired from Goldman Sachs after a career there of about 30 years and had been vice chair in 2004 when he retired. And then finally on the end here is Gene Sperling, who served as National Economic Advisor to President Clinton from 1997 to 2001. Gene, you now have too many jobs to keep track of. I think these are all concurrent. Senior Fellow for Economic Studies and Director of Center for Universal Education at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's U.S. Chair of the Global Campaign for Education. He's a Senior Fellow in Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. He's a contributing editor and columnist for Bloomberg News and a governor on the Philadelphia Stock Exchange Board. So a very busy man. Thank you all for being here, and I'll turn it over to you, Steve.
Thank you very much. Thank you. the first thing, if we're going to be talking about American competitiveness and the American economy, is just to set the stage, to answer the take a crack at the question Ed Koch, the long ago mayor of New York City, used to ask, how are we doing? And you know, there's a pretty much a custom in America that the party in power and that has the White House or people related to that party tend to see things bottle half full, and the party that's out tends to see it half empty. I've been selected to do this because of my Olympian detachment on these issues. So let me just read you from the front page of this morning's Wall Street Journal. Strong jobs data signal economy is gaining steam. Then the job market, solid performance in June, boom, 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 boom. And then a lot of facts and figures, which I wasn't hired to read the paper, but I'll just give you their summary. In short, the U.S. economy seems to be enjoying a Goldilocks moment, not too hot, not too cold. Now, what we've had is Greg Mankiw, who was a former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, said he'd always tell his students, if you want to get a snapshot of the economy at any time, you really want to look at give or take three basic benchmarks. The first was unemployment, and that's running at about 4.5. It's running at 4.5%, which is historically quite low. Second is inflation, and that is as the journal said, it's at a very manageable level, just maybe a little bit north of 2% on core inflation. So the famous, remember, everyone here looks old enough to remember the old misery index where you added those two together, that's doing quite well. And the third, Mankiw would cite, would be growth. And after some quarters of subpar performance, the U.S. economy is projected to get up to pretty close to the speed limit, which is a sustainable level of growth above which we start worrying about inflation. Some of the other things you look at are productivity, which has been quite strong in the U.S. and diverging favorably from the Europeans, and stock market and so on. Now, this is not a Pollyanna-ish moment. Well, what we can see today and what we're enjoying today, including very sizable tax receipts, et cetera, is very strong. When you look over the horizon, there are a great abundance of problems for policymakers and the next president of the United States and people who are concerned about these things to focus on. And in terms of American competitiveness, some of these will be discussed by this panel today. But just to list some of the things that are causes of serious worries. The U.S. oil dependency, and particularly in an era where environmental concerns are rising sharply, this is a major concern. Threats to trade liberalization, the encroaching democratic demographic. Gene, just
where's the Herculean detachment?
Yeah, it gets even worse because. Because the rest of the sentence was the demographic time bomb. Gene complained about the fact that we'd seated that he was on the far left here. People pointed out to him that it all depends on your perspective, and that from the audience's view, he's on the right, which is where he considers himself being in the Democratic Party. The dollar, a vulnerable dollar in the twin deficits. You know, one of the major problems that we have is risk to financial stability. You know, it's a problem where it may never turn out to be anything terrible, but lots of times you worry about a lot of things which don't turn out to pass, and you hope to take prophylactic action. So, financial stability and risks in a market that seems to be pricing risk in a very optimistic basis. Wealth disparities, not just in the United States, but throughout the world, and not only the malign effects they have, but what are the risks of the cures. our educational system, which is challenged. And I'd say that's a pretty good litany of risk to balance off the very favorable things that I've said about the current economy. Let me throw this open and ask Gene to take the oar. And just, Gene, how would you frame the issues? Give the audience an overview of how you see the issues of American competitiveness.
Well, Steve was asking me at breakfast kind of how would you define competitiveness. And I think that when we think about competitiveness in this case, what we're generally talking about is how is the United States competing at the high value-added levels of industry and services around the world. I mean, that's what we tend to think of as competitiveness. How are we doing, not at competing at the low end of the spectrum, but how are we competing for the high value-added services and production around the world? And, it won't be surprised, as Stephen said, that I probably would kind of look at the situation with even the current situation with a bit more concern in the following way. I think that we have to take very much more seriously whether we are seeing more of a divide between the rising tide and whether it's lifting all boats, and whether the economic logic that makes most sense for the typical company is necessarily what makes most sense for the typical worker. So, for example, if you're any of these gentlemen up here who are running companies, they have to seek the lowest cost production possible anywhere in the world. And part of the productivity gains they're going to have is by having the most efficient global supply chain possible. I mean, that's what they're compelled to do by the marketplace, and that is what they should do. And one shouldn't demonize companies for doing what they have to do to keep their companies afloat, to keep their market share, et cetera. However, if your test is not just productivity per se or competitiveness per se, but whether that is a rising tide that's lifting all boats, whether that productivity is bringing everybody with it, I think you have some harder questions. And I'll give you a statistic that's a little bit disturbing. We've had a very strong productivity growth over the last 5 or 6 years. Now, from around 94 to 2000, you saw productivity growth go up around 15-16%. And the wages of the typical American family went up by 15 or 16%. In the last 5-6 years, you've seen productivity go up a little quicker, 16% over a shorter period of time, and real median family income actually go down 2%. And so one is seeing, and these are not unrelated, when one looks at why you've had record corporate profitability, part of it is their effectiveness in maximizing an efficient global supply chain, which means sometimes for American workers that there's downward pressure on their wages. So I think when I'm framing and thinking about what the competitive challenge is, I think we have to ask ourselves, how are we competing for the new middle-class jobs of the future? Not simply how can our companies get the highest degree of productivity by getting the most efficient supply chain, they need to do that, but how do we encourage them, not just out of their patriotism, because that's, but not out of their patriotism, but out of their economic logic, to want to locate more of the high value-added jobs here. And I think that's the discussion that we're not having enough in the United States. And if we don't, then the fear is, and I think something all of us would fear, is that there'll be a negative reaction to the degree of globalization and openness we have. And that I'm very much against, because the openness of our economy, the innovation, the fact that we don't insulate ourselves from global competition, that's what keeps us at the cutting edge. That's what makes America the best productivity, best innovation economy. But if people don't feel they're benefiting from it, they'll turn against it. We'll have a shrinking pie, and people won't be raising. Now, we didn't want to get into all the issues here, but so I won't go into the discussion, but let me just kind of tick off the kind of things you'd be thinking about. Why are we not competing like crazy for the R&D jobs of the future? I mean, this is the high value-added job production. Yet there's a Business Week survey that shows that in telecom, of the exciting research things being done by U.S. companies, 52 out of 57 are happening outside of here. National Institute of Health has actually had a real cut in research. We spend $300 to $400 billion more a year on tax cuts and prescription drugs. We don't have any money to increase the research, the innovation, to help see if we can create more clusters of innovation that make it attractive for the innovation to be here. Two, energy. We know, everybody here knows, that in the future there will be millions of new middle-class jobs created on the energy alternatives. Shouldn't we here want to make sure that those jobs are happening here? Why don't we have a Marshall Plan, not of innovation and energy? Why aren't we supporting a gigantic energy DARPA that supports that type of innovation? Why are we not really, you know, Tom Friedman likes to say, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. We have the R&D jobs, the university competitiveness, that's where we still have a lead. Why aren't we doing everything to maximize that lead? Then what are we doing to encourage scientists? Yes, we should let the high... We should have more liberalization of the highest skilled immigrants being able to stay here, the highest skilled with PhDs and masters in engineering. We should have more ability for them to stay here. But that shouldn't be our long-term plan. Our long-term plan should be to go after the untapped pool of skills that are here. I think you had Shirley Ann Jackson here earlier. The 35% of women in the workforce but only make up 10 to 15% of the science and technology pool. The 24% of Americans who are African American, disabled, or Hispanic who make up 5 to 7%. We need to be reaching down and encouraging our own pool. Cutting NIH funding is the most discouraging thing for new scientists possible. We talk about it, these things, we want more scientists, and yet when you look at the path they have to go through, the pay scale, and then what they have to do just now to get cuts in research grant, we do virtually everything to discourage them. Lowering healthcare costs would make job creation more attractive here. And then there's just things that just make no sense at all, why we don't invest in early 0 to 5 education when we know the cognitive abilities that you need to be flexible and to think and adjust in the economy come at the earliest in life. Those are some of the issues that are not often enough on a competitiveness agenda. So I think we want to ask ourselves, not just how do we maximize productivity, how do we do that while also focusing in non-protectionist, non-Luddite ways on how we make it more attractive through often through public investment to have more of the new middle-class jobs of the future located here so that Americans still believe that an open global economy is a rising tide that does lift all boats and creates an inclusive middle class where everybody can work their way up, which is what our entire country was founded on. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. I think no matter what end of the political spectrum you're on, people agree that education is a crucial part of increasing American, improving American competitiveness. And in that context, Tom, you want to comment on the educational system and how it's working and how it's not working and what you think could be done better?
Yeah, and let me tie into maybe Gene's comments. As an employer, of course, what we want are educated, motivated people, and we're not getting them in America today, which is why we're going other places. And we all know that K through 12 is a disaster in America, and we're not really doing anything about it. I think part of the blame is on business. I think business needs to speak out. We have business in general has sort of gotten to, I'm only going to go to politicians so they'll give me what I want for my specific interests, and I'm not going to demand other things of them. And I think businesses need to start demanding from our government better education system. And you know, that's what we pay them for. That's what they should do. I'm struck by how the whole education thing seems to be stuck in the mud. Everybody's got their own corner, whether it's competitiveness or teacher salaries or teacher jobs, and nobody's doing anything really that looks like it will change the effort. And if it was a problem in our company, we'd put some real focus behind it and we'd do something different. Our suggestion would be something like a Marshall Plan for education. You'll remember the Marshall Plan was a temporary program. It used local governments to do that. and it had certain requirements around people delivering things. And I'm like, well, why don't we take $75 billion, give it to our local schools from the federal government over the next 5 years or something and say, do a couple things. Rebuild the infrastructure, both hard and soft, and secondly, build a system that could provide continual lifelong learning, because our employees don't need to stop learning at grade 12. They need to learn all the way through their life, because we used to use microfiche, now we don't. We use computers. And so in trying to get people to do that and to teach them, we need an infrastructure to do that as an employer. That's what I'm asking for as a customer of the government. And so I think we need to demand something, and I think it needs to be something that is different and gets some momentum.
Well, let me ask this question. The U.S. spends something like three times more than I think the next largest spender on K through 12 education. Somehow it seems to be working in our colleges, which are considered to be the best in the world. K through 12, it isn't working. We spend the money, and if you look at these standardized tests, we trail Latvia and 25 other countries in terms of math performance. What are we doing wrong?
You know, I mean, everyone's got their own things. You know, I would do a bunch of things differently, but I think you need money to do it differently. Trying to do the existing, get the existing system to change is, and I would say, you know, we spend more money in R&D than everybody else, too. We spend more money in defense than everybody else. And
but we like to think we get a payoff.
We do, but we also have this standard that every dollar in education has to be well spent. As far as I know, every bomb we drop in Iraq isn't hitting its mark. I'm like, you know, look, let's just look at it in total. Let's do something different. I recognize some of the money will be inefficient. Politically, the teachers would like this, construction union would like this, parents would like it. Economically, you'll reduce in Chicago, where I live, a bunch of the money spent in the school system is on fixing crappy old buildings. Well, so that money can't go into teacher training. I don't know. I just think we have to recognize it's broken. Let's put some money behind it and do something differently. Maybe it's not $75 billion from the federal government, but somebody needs to do something, because right now everybody's in their corners and nobody's coming together.
Steve, can I add to that? I think the corporate community's got to step up as well around K through 12 education and not leave it just to a Marshall Plan. I think the Marshall Plan idea is a good one, but I think that companies have a responsibility here as well. When I moved to New York in 98, I found that we had been involved with the Adlai Stevenson High School in the Bronx as one little micro example. And our people volunteer their time in mentoring students. Now, those of you from New York, Adlai Stevenson High School is a school that has a graduation rate of something in the mid to high teens. And our people mentor these students. They don't pick the easiest ones. They pick the toughest ones. And over the last 15 plus years, we've mentored 600 or 700 students to a graduation rate of 95%. And so I think that when companies, thank you, when companies, you know, involve their employees, involve their efforts, I think it compounds the effectiveness of funds that come from governments. And I think it's something that is past time for the corporate community to step up to.
Steve, I think it's clear, though, that the linkage here is between this issue of income gap that's unattractive, as Gene describes, for lots of reasons in our country, is really rooted in this issue of education. You know, 25 years ago, someone who graduated from high school versus someone that went to college, the gap was about 20 to 25%. Today, it's 45 to 50%. So basically, the return on education is rising, and that, as you were saying earlier, this is based on productivity, and education drives productivity. And people that don't have the education can't be more productive, and this is exacerbated and highlighted by the use of technologies and tools. And if you're not trained to use the technology and the tools and to have the skills to think broadly about how to use and think about the tools of the future and the skills, then you're destined to have this gap continue to widen. And so it really is an issue of education is the key secret weapon to attacking this income disparity. And if you don't attack education, you cannot solve it by trying to take from this group to give to that group. It's basically got to be driven by the skills, and that's got to be the focus. And the economics and the science is really clear that this is really the issue, and we have to accept that as a society if we want to tackle this.
Yeah, let me give you a story on Bob's thing. We had we have claim adjusters who go around and, you know, fix cars and houses and stuff like that, and we have computers that they use. One of our leaders was with one of them, and the person was taking all the stuff down on a piece of paper. And he said, well, how come you're not using a new computer, which was in her trunk? And she said, because I don't really know how to use it, and I'm embarrassed, and I'm really slow, and I'm faster with our customers this way. An intelligent choice on her part. But from our standpoint as an employer, if I can have somebody in India do that over the phone who knows the computer, who does it faster, who gets it into our system, it's cheaper. Why would I not do that? So finding a way to teach people to get contemporary when the world changes so fast. We all have the benefit of coming here and we learn, but I think we have to find a way to have lifelong learning, and we haven't cracked that code.
You've hit it right. This is all at the issue of outsourcing. Your customers, our clients, Goldman's clients, all want the right talent in the right place at the right price. And sadly today, the right place is probably the least important of those three. Technology is making that by far the least important. And so I think the right talent is fundamental, and that's where this whole issue of education comes in. And you're right, it doesn't stop when you hire someone. It really begins at that stage as well. It's a lifelong
education. Well, lifelong education is crucial, but if you talk to the people who are enormous users of this talent, the technology industry, they will tell you over and over where we need the help is in the early stages, in K through because if you lose them there, you've lost them. So it seems to me, though, that we still haven't gotten at the root of the problem of why it isn't working. We've talked about some fixes. Gene, you've studied this stuff. Let's give you a chance for a Nixon goes to China moment. To what extent is this problem related to the elephant in the room that we're not talking about? A bureaucratic, encrusted bureaucracy and unions that are resistant to new practices?
You know, I think trying to, you know, single out teachers' unions is not is not productive, and I think that what the most innovative people are doing is trying to kind of break those things down and work together. And I think there are people. And I think the smartest superintendents, I think, are trying to do that. But there's always resistance. But I think that just to make a point or two, I do agree that number one is education. But I said this in our earlier panel. We have to be honest with people a little too, which is that what I like to say is education is the most important, has never been more important, but it's never been less of a sure thing too. A college education is your best bet. A graduate education is a better bet. But a college education is less protection against globalization. So it's going to increase your chances. It's never been more important. But you're still going to have people facing that competition. And we have to be honest with them that it's still the best thing to maximize. Secondly, though, it's not the only thing people base location on. And I think looking at the broader issues of competitiveness, whether it's healthcare costs, how modern our infrastructure is, what the tax incentives are for our jobs, also should be part of it. But I really want to get to, and I'll answer your question in this way. I think Tom has made, what I just think is one of the most important points, so I just got to put an exclamation mark on it. The dynamic that happens in Washington is the following. You have a proposal. I mean, you see this with like Head Start. And people who all kind of come out and they try to get, there's a study that shows it's not working quite well. And the people who are coming out with those studies, what their solution they want to be is, therefore we shouldn't spend a lot of money on early pre-K. So what happens is that everybody kind of rallies to defend that. And so you get this problem where you get less innovation, less experimentation, less admitting things were wrong. And what bothers me about that mentality is, and it goes to Tom's point, is we don't say that about cancer. We don't say, boy, you know, the first few experiments didn't work. If we took the approach that he is suggesting, if we said, it is just inexcusable, the situation for young black males in our country is a national disgrace. It is an outrage. It's a disgrace. We should all be ashamed it exists every day. We should be ashamed at what a disadvantage a child has by the accident of their birth by the time they're 5 years old. Now, let's do something about it like it's AIDS or cancer. Let's have that research. Now, if you then said, we are committed as a country to spending what it needs to fix that, then we would encourage all the experimentation, innovation. People would be then willing to admit that they missed a few bombs, that it failed, because they knew it wasn't going to be undercutting the whole enterprise. Mm-hmm. It was going to be suggesting that we tried a slightly different. So one, I think if we had that attitude that we are willing to spend the resources, and it's okay to admit things aren't working, because it doesn't mean we'll spend less, it just might mean we spend more, but in a better, smarter way, I think we'd have a better attitude. And secondly, one thing we could at least do, Stephen, is fund the things we know that works. Teach for America is an amazing success. How can it be that they're taking 1 out of 10 Ivy League school kids who want to go teach in underprivileged areas? One of the things that's incredibly successful are these early intervention programs where colleges, businesses are reaching the kids 5th, 6th grade and trying to give them some of the expectations that a person like myself born into an upper middle class family was just born with. A lot of these things are working. So one of the things we should ask ourselves is why are we not replicating and expanding the things that we at least know are working that are affecting the motivation and aspiration of young people?
Thanks, Gene. It's clear if you look at American competitiveness, you look at productivity, the underpinnings for this, and I think this has been generally considered to be true for many, many years and accepted by economists from all parts of the political spectrum, is you have to have entrepreneurialism. You have to have the famous economist Schumpeter called about the way the gales of creative destruction that sweep away the old and give us new products, new ways of doing things, new ways of organizing. And that requires flexibility in an economy. That's one of the key things in the U.S. economy. Jim Turley, one of the things that's constantly talked about in that connection is regulation is important and helpful and necessary and keep us from getting poisoned by bad stuff coming in from China, but overregulation reduces that necessary flexibility. Where do you see this?
You know, this issue of regulation is obviously one that our profession lives with a lot. I had the honor of being in the first roundtable that Hank Paulson put together on U.S. capital markets competitiveness. And what was interesting was how initially going in, I thought the focus was going to be on, you know, the accounting firm stink and Sarbanes-Oxley is the scourge of the earth. What actually turned to me to be a consistent theme throughout is one of regulatory mindset and temperament. We had a comparison of the head of the Financial Service Authority in the UK sitting alongside people from the SEC, and I think the real issue became one of why is it that here in this country, 1 in 10 public companies restate their financial statements last year, almost. And I tried to get a count across Europe or across Asia. You can't get a count because it's so few they don't even count. Is it because the company community, the registrants and the auditors are doing a better job in Europe? Some might snicker at that. Is it because the regulator's not looking as deeply? Don't know. Or is it because they have a different mindset? A regulatory mindset that is more principles-based as opposed to detail rules-based, a mindset that is more risk-focused, what's the real harm to an economy, as opposed to enforcement or punishment-focused, and a regulatory mindset that is more forward-looking as opposed to backward-looking. I think that's one of the things that there's committees being formed now to look through these issues. We're seeing fundamentally different approaches to regulation around the world. And from everything I hear traveling the world is the investor groups. The investors in each part of the world are essentially equivalently satisfied. And so I think we need to figure out what's happening here. I think there is a real dose of let's look at global regulation in a different way.
Steve?
Yeah.
I think that this has been something that's really, I think, we want to be a hallmark of the place that I work at Treasury. And the way I think about it is that the engines of the economy basically work like this. You have people who have capital that they'd like to invest and earn a return, and you have people who have ideas and ambitions and would like to have capital to invest. And the cross really is this bridge that goes between the two. And to the extent, from a public policy perspective, we can make this bridge comfortable, easy, fast, but safe for the investor and for the people who are using capital, and that that bridge is working well, the net effect will be more productivity, and it will move in a frictionless fashion, and you'll basically have a lower cost of capital so that projects will be funded and it'll spur greater growth. When we've looked at this, we've found there are three issues that seem to be the challenges for friction on the bridge. Basically, the regulatory environment in the United States that's grown up over 50 years. Number two is the litigation perspective that's developed. And number three is an accounting industry that basically is a bit off the path and needs to be helped to be get back on the path. This is not a lambasting of accounting. Accounting is mission critical.
I wouldn't take
critical.
It that way, would you?
Accounting is mission critical because it really gives you the confidence to make sure the bridge is working. And for a variety of reasons, accounting has gotten off the path, and now it's really a public policy issue to have accounting that works, is trusted, and is adding to the confidence so the bridge is working in the right way.
Obviously, you know, Hank Paulson was easier on the accountants than you are.
What's interesting is I actually agree 100% with what Bob said. And more than I agree with it, we convene dialogue discussions of audit committee chairs around the world. And whether it's audit committee chairs in this country or audit committee chairs across Europe and Asia, they have the exact same big three. Regulatory environment here in the U.S., the litigation environment in the U.S., and I would focus it more on the complexity of the accounting and how it is just driving some aberrant behavior by all participants in the market. And so, you know, to me, I'm a glasses half full as opposed to half empty. I think we've got the right groups at Treasury looking at the regulatory issues, at the SEC, forming a commission to look at complexity. And so, and across Europe, you're actually seeing a deep focus on litigation exposures that has not yet gotten as much focus in this country, but I think will. You know, one of the nuggets that came out of a previous meeting I was in, if you look at big, call it billion-dollar transactions in this country, M&A deals, 40 to 50% of the time a billion-dollar deal gets done, within the next 2 to 3 days, there's a lawsuit filed, a plaintiff's class action, a plaintiff's attorney filing a lawsuit. This attorney who was in this session with us said he had tried to find out how frequently that happens in the UK, in Paris, in Stuttgart, and couldn't find one. Someone remembered maybe a decade ago that it happened. So I think these three issues are the right issues.
Yeah. Well, just go back to your prior career in investment banking. How many different regulators did you have to deal with throughout the world?
76. Basically, give or take.
That was not a setup question.
Nope. I worked with Steve at Goldman Sachs and was responsible for an area where we basically bought and sold securities around the world. So basically, it wasn't a made-up answer. That was the number of people with whom we were regulated all around the world. And in the United States, we have an incredibly successful system that's developed over a long period of time, really out of the 30s and 40s. But we have a lot of inconsistencies that need attention. Now, banks are regulated by four different entities. Doesn't make a lot of sense. We have this tussle between, just as we should, on this crucial issue of federalism versus states' rights with regard to certain issues. You know, insurance companies are regulated by the states. There's no optional federal charter. And that's basically creates friction, and it eliminates people seeing products, at the most exciting new products, quickly at the lowest cost because you have the friction of 50 different borders to go across. And you can just see that there are new ways to look at this. What we've said at Treasury is one of the things we're going to try to do in the next 20 months is to basically try to write something that's a blueprint for what a brand new, if you were starting from scratch, regulatory environment would look like. And so we'll work hard on this, and we're not naive. But I've learned in the way in Washington, the way these things work is you start the dialogue, and then hopefully it gets picked up and gets carried on. In 1993, there was something written called the Green Book, which basically looked at banking regulation, and it basically was probably a thud when it first came out. It didn't hit the bestseller list. But you know, 5 or 6 or 7 years later, that became the foundation for Graham-Leach-Bliley. So we have new, more forward-looking bank rules and laws and regulation because of that. So our goal at Treasury is going to be to try to frame the issue for the next decades on what a forward-looking regulatory environment should look like that balances investor protection and also encourages capital to move in the right way.
Great. Well, when you do this, I want to give you a tip for someone to look at. You may have bigger fish to fry. My favorite over-regulation thing is in the supermarket that we shop at in New York, there's a big sign that says if you want to buy beer, regardless of age, you have to show ID. So I find as this line here is slowed down by senior citizens like me and others finding our Social Security cards, in a way it's flattering, but in a way it's kind of slowing up productivity. I'm honored, but in one of the regulatory things that's come up, Bob, and it's right in your strike zone, we've just seen in the last few weeks a Bear Stearns hedge fund blow up. We've had others blow up. It can be predicted with a high degree of confidence that we're going to see more of these in the future. The question is framed very simply. In the press, shouldn't hedge funds be regulated? It's framed by your counterparts in Europe. What's your perspective?
Well, it's something that we spent a lot of time on. Let's start with a couple of facts or descriptions. You know, they're about, it's been an incredibly successful business organization. A hedge fund isn't an investment strategy. It's a way that people come together to hire a money manager, and basically...
It's a compensation strategy is what it is.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And but so, that's okay.
So this compensation strategy it basically has been incredibly successful. They're $2.5 trillion. 80% of the money is in the United States. It's been quite successful, and the beneficiaries have been the limited partners who've benefited, for the most part, from the extraordinary returns. And they've been universities, individuals, pension funds, et cetera. But now you have this, when I started in the business, it was a couple hundred billion dollars, and now it's $2.5 trillion. So there's issues and questions of systemic risk as to how should this group of people be regulated. And that's the right question to ask. So then you say, okay, we know we want to ask that question. Well, what are you interested in? I think you're interested in three things. You're interested in investor protection, you're interested in market practices, and you're interested in systemic risk. Now, in two of those, we have very specific direct regulation. The SEC is responsible for writing rules as to who can invest in hedge funds, and they basically are adjusting those rules right now, and the SEC has direct line of sight on this issue. The second issue is market practices, insider trading, all the insidious things that undermine confidence in the market. Again, hedge funds are different than mutual funds or pension funds. The SEC has the exact same line of sight that they do on any other investor. The third issue is tricky. Now they're this large pool of assets, and how should you care and manage and monitor the issue of systemic risk? And that's really the hard issue. And there are really two choices. You can decide that the government's going to take this on, and they're going to train a group of analysts or people that are going to go visit the hedge funds and look and see who's taking risk. Or you can take what we call an indirect method, whereby the people that lend them the money, the banks and the other financiers, who all are regulated, every single one of them are regulated, and so instead, what we favored is an indirect form of regulation by looking at the lenders to hedge funds and requiring them, when you inspect the lending institutions, to make sure they've got the right collateral and have the right line of sight on the risks that they're taking. So that's the public policy issue as to which one you prefer. And so I think that the reality is, as I said, there are 8,000 hedge funds. Some will be successful. Some will not do well. And so really the question is, how is it working? And I think it's improving. What we did, and I'm sorry, this is going
no,
on a
this
bit.
Is,
But at the President's Working Group, which was birthed in 1988 by Ronald Reagan and is chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury, and it includes all four of the major regulators, the Secretary of the Treasury, the head of the SEC, the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, and the Chairman of the CFTC. And what we did is we endorsed this idea of indirect regulation with regard to systemic risk, and we wrote 10 principles and guidelines that we thought gave very strong guidance to each of the four participants. To the limited partners, don't invest unless you have certain information. To the lenders, the people that fund hedge funds, you shouldn't lend money unless you have good line of sight on your collateral. If you don't understand all the risks, you should have more margin against it. And the regulators, the third group, will enforce it, and managers should have best practices too. So that's what we've done to incorporate this.
You know, but as a big investor, we have a fair amount of money invested. Of course, we have a $122 billion investment portfolio, and we got some money in hedge funds. But here's the problem I have with that approach, which is economics is like water. It flows to the open thing. And so if you ask our investors interested in transparency, SEC telling you exactly how to account for something, all those kinds of things, the answer would be no, because $2.5 trillion now move to hedge funds, which don't have any reporting requirements, don't have any transparency stuff. So when we go out to compete, so I'm now competing to make money in the financial markets, if I want to make an investment in something, it takes our accountants somewhere between 30 and 60 days to figure out how we would account for something. By this time, the hedge fund's already invested and they're long gone. No investment opportunity. So if it really needs to be a level playing field, and if the intention of the government is, okay, we don't like our regulated system with all the burdens on it, we're going to move a bunch of money into an unregulated system, then this is a good strategy. If it is not, then what you are going to get is there's going to be a whole bunch of money that has no accountability. I mean, if you look at our 10K, it's like 200 pages today. Like, who can read the thing? No hedge fund has to do any of that work, and yet they have more money than we do. So I'm struggling with this. Oh, you need to be regulated, you need to pay attention to the SEC, you need to have all these regulators all over you because it's for financial stability. And then we're going to let all these other people just do what they want.
Well, I see. I would just add something to Bob's answer, which I thought was very good. You can start out with the assumption that you would like to have transparency and reduce risk to the financial system in the hedge fund area. You can start out with the absolute assumption that long-term capitals are going to blow up from time to time. So I think a lot of Bob's answer related to just the efficacy of the system. You have to form a judgment whether it's possible to train a pool of government regulators who could keep track of an industry which is moving, and whatever their positions were today, you can be sure they're going to be different next Tuesday. Or you can say, we're going to have a de facto form of regulation by the people who are loaning them the money, who have got a financial vested interest in making sure that they're not overextending themselves, and who are watching them every day and who can afford the kind of analytical talent that's necessary to have visibility on them.
I would be okay with that system. Just give us the same thing. That would be my only request. Just give us the same thing that they have. I mean, well, we were in capital markets just like
that. You know, get Bob Steele pushing for you.
Yeah.
I mean, this is incredibly complicated stuff, and this is obviously an area where there's tremendous potential for unintended consequences, and well-intentioned regulations do more harm than good. But, you know, I don't have a lot of problem with having relatively unregulated, high-income, sophisticated people invest their money and lose their money, but you have to ask if you're in situations like with long-term capital where the view is that it's too big to fail, where there's going to be spillover effects to the public, are the particular people lending, are they going to have that mentality on the systemic risk in mind? And I don't feel as confident of that. Larry Summers always likes to say that crisis always happens right after the moment where everybody who's raised the concerns has been wrong so long that nobody stops worrying. But, you know, the fact is that everybody in this room has fire insurance. you have a very tiny percent chance of having a fire in your house.
But not, I'd be happy to tell you.
I just want you to see that the Democrat here is trying to build up the business interest here, and he's
he'll sell it right after he sells his 10K.
I'm trying to build up the insurance industry, but the point is that you take risk against small occurrences when you think they'll have very, very large negative impacts, and that's the tough issue in dealing with stuff that has huge financial systemic risk, which is it may have a relatively small percentage chance of happening, but if the impact is so difficult that we, the public, are going to have to come in and essentially be part of saving them because they're too big to save, then I still have to ask, can you count on the people lending the money who have to look at their particular interest, to look at a larger systemic risk that and a moral hazard that they may feel will come on to the rest of the government. And that's not to critique that. I just because I understand the complication of this issue, but I guess I would probably be a little more concerned and probably a little bit of a guess that sometime over the next 10 years we might. Might think we might have done a little bit more on the transparency side than we're headed to right now.
I think the transparency, I agree with your issue, and my solution from a public policy perspective is the transparency should be with the regulator, and whether that regulator is the Federal Reserve, or whether that regulator is the SEC, or whether it's the OCC, which would be the three key people, they have direct line of sight into the regulated entity, and that's the indirect regulation that we've endorsed. And you either have to go with that, or you have to basically go with the idea that you think you can hire enough supervisors to go in the field and to root out what might be the spark, to use your fire insurance, how's that, Tom? Fire insurance opportunity, and to basically go it that way. So that'd be the public policy disagreement.
Steve, I find myself also thinking about the intersection and the convergence of the hedge funds with private equity, because I think that's clearly happening. And also, there's wildly different worldviews on private equity. You hear, the Germans on occasion call them locusts.
Yeah.
You hear others see private equity as being a key driver to productivity improvement and, in fact, competitiveness improvement. And so I think that's an issue that is also very important.
I just want to, Gene, just say one thing. You mentioned a few times too big to fail and, had the long-term capital. I think the investors in long-term capital, I think, lost something like $5 billion. There was a complete smash to the people who put money in that hedge funds. What happened is the Federal Reserve convened a lot of Wall Street people and said, rather than have them dump their assets, would some of you like to convert your loans to them into equity positions? But the moral hazard, if you were an investor in long-term capital and they ran into a wall as they did, you smarted quite seriously. Let's do this. I think we've covered an awful lot of topics, and I'd like to save a little time for questions from the floor. So maybe we can throw it open to see if this has sparked any questions or from anyone. And if they have, I think there are microphones, and you can state your. If you'd be good enough to state your name, and then we'll.
My name is Kim Anderson. I'm from Minneapolis. I make automobile parts for domestic and foreign vehicles, and do it profitably. I would like each individual's brief opinion in terms of where we are competitively in America and in the world.
Jim, you want to?
Yeah, I think we. First, I lived in Minneapolis and was out in Wayzata for a while, so it was great to hear from you, Kim. I think competitively today we're in fine shape. I think that the demographics are a real concern point, and I think the educational aspects that we spoke of earlier are a concern point. Today, I think we are very, very competitive, and I think we've got to deal with those two issues to stay that way.
Kim, I think we're very competitive, but I think we need to change our mindset in terms of where our public infrastructure is, that today there's many more opportunities, many more places for companies and capital to go, whether that be Asia or Mexico or various other places. And we've not yet come to grips with the fact in this country that we're competing with these other countries, and so we need an education system, we need effective government to do that. And I'm worried that that it might be too late. There's a line out of, I think it's a F. Scott Fitzgerald book, it says, "How did you go bankrupt?" And it was gradually, then suddenly. And so I'm worried that we have not yet woken up to the fact that America's competing.
100% agree. Basically, the competition's gotten better. They've taken our playbook. Everywhere around the world, people are using the market-based mechanism to allocate resources. They've discovered that this has the best chance of creating growth, higher employment, and lower inflation. And basically, we've got to keep getting better and not be complacent in order to stay the best.
Dean?
Well, I feel at a competitiveness level in terms of kind of our economic model, in terms of our focus on innovation and entrepreneurship, and again, the willingness to not insulate ourselves from competition. We have an excellent model, but what I think I've tried to say is, and I was actually encouraged by some of the things they're saying, we got to get rid of this kind of, are you for spending, tax cuts, that kind of stuff. You know, what you're talking about is spending. That's demonized in Washington, D.C. We got to start asking what's actually best for our competitiveness. And where I think our challenge is, as I said, is, are we doing enough to make people like yourself feel that it is competitive for you to keep the high value added jobs here? We don't want to keep job location, of course, here. I mean, all job location here. Of course, people need to locate and take advantage of market share other places, get the economies of scale, build relationships. But there's a certain amount of production and services that could be done anywhere. And I think we need more. I think we need to be more open to a type of a public investment strategy that allows us to, again, compete more for the new middle class jobs of the future. And I think we also have to figure out ways that we can do more for workers without doing the problems that you've seen where you're discouraging job taking. So for example, universal health care or things like wage insurance, these are things that help workers in between jobs, but they don't discourage people from getting back and looking for new jobs. They're not the type of European model that actually gives you perhaps an incentive to stay off the job. So I think we can be smart about getting the best of having more economic security without, as Steve likes to say, killing the goose that laid the golden eggs. And the one thing I would remember when it gets to individual people, Bob Shiller has a really interesting book about risk-taking for individuals. You know, one of the reasons why we take so much, you can take risk as a small business here, is that if you try and fail, you don't go to debtor's prison. You go to bankruptcy, and that's not easy, but you can start again and try again. And I think, you know, for a lot of people in the United States, we want people to feel that way with their own lives, that they can take risks on new jobs, on new companies, on starting their own businesses, and not feel, as I feel a lot of Americans feel, that the fall is going to be so deep and so devastating that they start taking less risk in themselves. And that's the way I think having a bit more economic security for more workers can actually make people less risk adverse, more willing to accept a more open and innovative economy, and to take chances on their own higher education, knowing that if they miss, there's second and third chances in our economy.
I'll give you a slightly different answer. I think it's clearly industry specific. If you look at the industry that a bunch of us are related to, have been involved with, financial services, we have absolutely been dominant in the world stage. Other companies are trying to rip off our playbook, but the U.S. is very strong. They're entrepreneurial. We have too damn many of our best college kids going into financial services businesses. They should be doing lots of other stuff. We have too many lawyers, too many investment bankers, too many kids whose deepest aspiration in life is to be a hedge fund guy rather than being a scientist or doing something else. Then you take your industry, which you know a lot more about than I do, but I'm going to comment anyways. If you look at we ought to be doing a national lessons learned. Like the military does more or less in Israel, after the Lebanon embarrassment, they appointed a high-level group to look at what did they do wrong. Well, you look at the auto industry, there's got to be how did we go from a dominant position in the world to the parlous, dangerous state we're in today? I think you'll see some common denominators. I think you'll see a common denominator of weak management that when the auto industry looked at the Lexus back in the mid-'80s, it was a giant wake-up call. all of a sudden they realize the Japanese can not only make it cheaper than us, they can make it better than us and cheaper than us. So we had management that wasn't making cars people really wanted to buy, and we had management that was going along with the unions and making promises that they couldn't possibly fulfill. And so now you have the situation you're in now where you look at the credits of General Motors and Ford, and who 30 years ago would have believed that? You can look at the airline industry, you can look at the steel industry, and you will see common denominators. Managements that didn't adapt with the times, didn't go with the creative destruction that new sweeping in, and restrictive work practices, heavily unionized industries. So in those industries, you know, it's very hard to run a successful airline today unless you've come through bankruptcy, and even then, it is. So I'd give you a mixed answer. We've got a lot of work to do, and we need a national lessons learned on this. So that's my answer. Other questions? Sir.
Well, I'm sorry, I had my thing on here. Bill Coleman, serial entrepreneur, Silicon Valley, but the important thing is that last 2 years I've been the chairman of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, 210 companies, $1 trillion in revenue, and we believe we're losing our international competitiveness. It's all about brains. It's all about brains in our schools, and it's all about being able to hire them. 53% of our engineers in Silicon Valley are foreign-born. Here's an example. Biotech is the leading growth industry, $62 billion in revenue, the largest growth industry in high-tech in California today. The seed corn is PhDs. Over 50% of the PhDs in the world are graduated from universities in the United States. This year, before one could be hired, all H-1B visas were gone. We will hire them, and we'll hire them in India and China, and we'll grow the next level of research over there. So a two-part proposal for Tom's Marshall Plan, very simple. First, STEM is what it's called, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Every graduate degree grant in the United States should get at least a 5-year visa renewable. Lift the caps on H-1B visas internationally for bringing those people in. This is where we're going to build the next generation companies. Second, K-12 education. The biggest problem is teachers. Disgrace. The average teacher makes between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. How are we going to attract and retrain those people? I love Teach for America, but most of them will not stay teaching for 30 to 40 years. The problem is, one, we got to give them better lifetime training, and two, we have to give them a salary that they can live on. This is a very naive plan, but some part of it should be looked at. For half the cost of the Iraq war today, we can double their salaries. Now let me tell you what I mean. There's about 1 million teachers, K-12. That's $40 to $50 billion a year. We're spending well over $100 billion a year. Take a program, put 10-year sunset on it to transfer to state and local. Divide it into two parts for that $40 to $50 billion to double their salaries. One third pays for their summer. Volunteer program in which they can go get continuing education for the rest of their lives. Two thirds is a program that we have to figure out how to keep from being run by politicians, in which we can give a bonus to teachers for results of their students. That could double or triple the salary for the best teachers. We have one model here that really works. We have the best college education system in the world. It's because we compete for students and we compete for teachers. And the third thing is find some way to leverage, and this is really going to be the hardest part, through some sort of vouchers, the advantages we're seeing in the KIPP and the charter kinds of programs so that students can be competitive.
Bill, that's Bill Coleman founded one of the great technology successes, so he's a man who speaks not only from a tremendous practical base, but also obviously on a conceptual level. Is there a website you could cite this group to so people could look at your program and, you know, study and get their minds around it?
I wish the whole program is together, but we have parts of it on this. It's the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, svlg.org website. We have proposals in these areas.
svlg.org.
SV, Silicon Valley
Leadership
Group. Now, it's not all there, though, the way.
Yeah, no, that's terrific, Bill. One of the points
can you
that...
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yeah, sure. Go
SVLG, Silicon Valley Leadership Group, .org.
You know, one of the points that Bill made, which I just would like to underscore, it's not just getting those scientists and those brains in to do the current work of the corporation. You know, as Tom has mentioned, he'd love to hire Americans, but if he can't get the ones he needs, he's going to get that work done overseas. That's not good for the U.S., but in many ways the worst part of it is if we don't have the people doing the work here, when the guy spins off from Allstate and founds a technology company that revolutionizes some area of the business, he's doing it in Mumbai or in China. You know, Sergey Brin, one of the co-founders of Google, was a Russian immigrant. We really need those spin-off businesses that the tech. It's this tremendous viral system that we have to keep going here. So I think there's room for passion on this issue, sir.
Could I make a comment about immigration for a second? From a commercial standpoint, I just don't get why we don't have open immigration. I mean, it just blows my mind. I mean, you know, here we have a product that we're selling, which is Americanism, and whether they are, Bill, if they're PhDs and they want to come to work here, why wouldn't we want to have them? There's somewhere between 3 to 5 million people who want to come into the United States who can't get in here. They've applied, and we don't want to let them in. And I don't get it because... in fact, we want to throw out the people who snuck in, which, you know, there's 12 million of them. Near as I can figure out, that's 4% of our consumers. So I'm not sure which business would like to lose 4% of their consumers, but it wouldn't be us. And I just don't get why business isn't standing up and saying, you know, we need open immigration. It's a good thing. Have more people come in. We'll have more growth. We'll have more growth, we'll get past the retirement problem because we have more people working. It just blows my mind that business, and so I would, Bill, to your group, and I think to all business people, we should be demanding as a customer of the government that we want open immigration. It's just ridiculous.
Can I, you know, I negotiated the last H-1B increase in the Clinton administration, and it was an interesting experience. Very interesting. But I think it's important when you're doing these things to get stuff done policy-wise, you have to understand the legitimate concerns of others. I think there's a trust issue, and I think, Tom, this would be a great area to see Silicon Valley and others reach out. And here's the trust issue. The typical worker needs to believe that they're not just being passed over for no reason. A lot of workers look at this and think, you know, if I heard the number of times somebody said to me, how many times I got this, here's an article about engineers laid off in a city, and here's an article about somebody complaining that there's an engineering shortage in the same city. And so I think what we need is, the H-1B program is probably not a great program because it kind of includes kind of very semi-skilled and then very high-skilled. I think what would make more sense is to have, I think, unlimited immigration for the most highest skilled, for the truly best and brightest, the PhDs who will help you keep your jobs here. But I think the trade-off for doing that is really showing the typical person that who's lost their job somewhere, that the reason someone's going somewhere else is not just because it was going to take an extra 3 months to train them, or it was just slightly more costly to do so. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of articles written about the so-called engineering shortage, and there's a lot of interesting, but I think it's an area where we could actually bring people together. I think if you could create greater trust that there was more happening to retrain every worker you could get more acceptance of the immigration at the highest level, and I think that's a place to come together. And I just have to emphasize one of the points you said. It's just easy to sit there and say everybody should become a scientist, et cetera. I tell you, my sister, tenured scientist in immunology at University of Chicago, I admire her like I admire people who work in refugee camps. I mean that. I mean, she could have gone to med school. She'd gotten into 3 of the top 5 law schools. It is a total sacrifice of income and comfort to do something that's greatly in our national interest. And then we freeze NIH for 3 years, so they have to lay off their grad students and the people in their labs. I mean, if we're serious about all this stuff about encouraging science and teachers, then we got to actually make it easier for real live sons and daughters of ours to actually feel those are attractive paths to go into. And that's a public policy issue we could do something about.
Sir, you've been very patient.
Mine's more of a statement than it is a question, but it's one that should I feel should be addressed. You say that the hedge funds and the private equities are looked at by their lenders, et cetera. As an investment advisor, I came up through the ranks of a broker. I took tests. I did all this. I was looked at. I was sued. I was done everything to, and became an investment advisor. And, you know, it's okay. Hedge fund, they can be a wet behind the ear, 21-year-old, know nothing about it, fill out a little form, send it to Washington, and they're a hedge fund. If I go in and I want to make, let's say, a $10 million investment, nothing, I got to put up 50%. Hedge fund, he puts up anywhere from 10 to 20%. There is no way that that is a level playing field, and it's you've got to watch it, because if not, it's going to be the downfall of the economy. Thank you.
Sir.
Hi there. I was wondering if I could gather some data before I ask my question. Could I get the educational experience of your children, K through 12, on the panel? Maybe where they went to school?
K through 12?
K through 12. Steve, where did your kids go to school, K through 12?
They went to, we started out our oldest in public school in New York. It was an idealistic and noble experiment, which lasted 2 weeks.
Okay.
And then they all went to private schools in New York.
Okay.
We have one son, and he went to public schools throughout in St. Louis, in Minnesota, and in New York.
In the cities or
no,
outside?
No, in Scarsdale, so it's okay, sort of semi-public.
All right, there we go.
And then there's Northwestern.
And next?
Three kids all in private school.
And next?
Started school in England and regular local schools, and then to private schools and universities.
The Democrat?
My 15-month-old is okay. Still.
Okay.
I inherited a 12-year-old, and I'd say he's gone about 5 years to public school and 2 years to private
okay,
school.
Okay, and that now has
okay,
set
so
you
I have
up
the
for
data.
The following point.
So the point is, will we ever change K through 12 when all the powerful people opt out for private schools or quasi-private schools, Scarsdale, and until this happens, are we really going to change K through 12?
I just want to tell you what a good question I think this is. And you're right. I do put I moved my son from public schools in L.A., and my wife, making this whole move, wanted to make sure that he was in private schools. The first time anybody in our entire family, brothers and sisters, anybody had ever done it. And I do it because I got to do what's best for my 12-year-old. But I got to tell you, I feel like I am part of an apartheid system in Washington, D.C. I feel terrible about it. I'm not willing to make an experiment on my son, but I think public policy-wise, you're absolutely right. And the idea that, and to be honest, if I'd sent him to a public school, it wouldn't matter anyways, because you have two private school systems. One, you pay high tuition. The other, you pay a huge premium on your house so you
right.
can send your kid to other
exactly.
so you can say you're going to public schools.
That's the quasi-private
that
school.
That is a quasi-private school. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. And you know what? I don't want to deny that I'm doing it, and I feel terrible about it, but I'm still going to do what's best for my 12-year-old. And the only way I can feel good is to make sure that I don't let that affect what I do policy-wise, and I spend all my life, you know, trying to focus to make sure kids in the public schools are getting a chance again.
Well,
that's just the truth.
Let me come back to that point. There's no question that when you have active, aggressive parents who demand the services, and Scarsdale is certainly an epitome of that, you're going to get different results. I don't think that you have to be the head of a Fortune 100 company to understand that your kid's future is dependent on education. I think most of the people in this audience probably came from families where education was an important part of the life, even if it was a Depression era and there was no money around. I think the real question is, why are the average parents in America willing to live with a school? You know, when they do the studies, they find that people tend to be satisfied with their own school system. They are under-demanding consumers. Why are they satisfied with a system that has their kids' comparative standings on the standardized tests so poor against the rest of the world? I don't understand it. I don't understand it. There's a market failure, but I don't think you need that only rich people can drive very successful school systems. That's... Ma'am.
Yes, my name is Lorraine Harrington from Silicon Valley. I had two recent aha experiences I wanted to communicate. Recently, my son graduated from Princeton, and like 50% of the students in the economics department were going to Wall Street, and in fact, most of the engineering people were going to Wall Street. The second thing, experience I had, I was in India, and I went to a girls' middle school, and we asked them to raise their hand and say, what do they want to do in their future? And this is all girls. 90% of them either wanted to be software engineers or doctors. There is no way in the U.S. that that would happen in a girls' middle school. So what can we do to get the motivations of these kids focused on innovative jobs?
On which jobs?
On innovative jobs, on engineering and science. Our kids are not thinking about that.
Anyone want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, I mean, this is... You know, Shirley Ann Jackson, I think, was here earlier, talks about this, which is that you mentioned girls, and you know, this is large. We have a workforce that is not going to grow as much as it did. So in the past, we've produced more college-educated, more science and tech people just by kind of labor force growth. Now we've got to actually get more people in a kind of more stagnant pool to want to do those things. The people who are not seeking those jobs are girls, young women. 35% are in the workforce, but they make up only 10 or 15% of science technology. A lot of them lose interest around 6th and 7th grade. They're outperforming boys earlier. I'm so against any kind of segregation, but I have to say the studies about letting girls segregate in the schools for 5th, 6th, 7th grade, the kind of stuff Sally Ride is doing. I think the question is you've got to reach people at early ages, high motivational. It's not just about the standards. It's about motivating people at a very early age. And it is women, African Americans, Hispanics, and people with disabilities who make up about 60% of the workforce and are going to be fulfilling just a very small fraction of the number of jobs. That's the unrealized talent pool for science tech innovation in our own country. And, you know, I don't think we could do enough to try to reach out, but I think it's got to be early. It's got to be early. You can't wait till 10th, 11th. I don't think you can wait till 11th grade.
With H-1B visas is, I mean, I'm in Silicon Valley. Yes, half the engineering graduates or more come from India and China. That's why we've got to hire them. I mean, if you look at the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, you know, the number of entrepreneurs that have come from India is like 25% of the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, there's a motivation issue that's happening here that's not happening. We're not instilling in women, absolutely, but also in the general population.
Well, I think you're being a bit pessimistic. I think, let me just make one example. The competition for the graduates at the top colleges now is there's a race to the top by two organizations I'm familiar with, Goldman Sachs and Teach for America. And a lot of schools now, Teach is beating Goldman Sachs, which I have mixed emotions about. But so I think that the real issue is if we create the right inspirational activities, people will respond. The issue isn't with the children. The issue is we haven't created the vehicles by which people can be inspired. And so there's a good example where let's, you know, give it up for Wendy Kopp, basically, for creating something that's been the vehicle by which this can be presented.
What percentage of great scientists, when they were asked why they got into it, allude to the fact they were inspired by a great teacher early on? And that, I think last comment, because we've run out of time.
The only thing I would add to this is, in India, engineers are rock stars. I mean, they get a lot of publicity and a lot of celebration. Here in this country, frankly, Wall Street, hedge funds, and private equity has been, the rock stars. And I think we need to do a lot more as a society to celebrate entrepreneurship and to celebrate the engineering and science disciplines.
Thank you very much.